Welcome back. You're back with us here at Unusual Sources on 93.3 CFMU FM. And like I was saying earlier, we wanted to give an update with some coverage on the referendum that occurred in Venezuela about term limits. And the newspapers have been covering that one way. And if you're in Venezuela, you might see it a different way. So we should have on the line with us today, George. And of course, it's George Ciccarello Moore, who is a PhD candidate at Berkeley University. And he is also a columnist. He writes for a number of publications, including Counterpunch. So we're very pleased to have him with us on the show today. George, how are you today?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm not bad. I'm just I'm glad we have your voice. Sometimes the international connections don't always work, but it's very well today. So again, thanks very much for coming with us. I wanted to talk about the New York Times position on term limits generally or as it applies to New York, because this is something that you've covered, something that you've noticed in your research. How would you say that the New York Times position on term limits in New York has developed within the past few years?
Well, it's not so much that it's developed, it's that it's just openly hypocritical. Firstly, I would say that the Times has a principled, what it claims is to be a principled opposition to term limits. The Times will occasionally claim that term limits are undemocratic and should be opposed in a general principled sense. And this is something that they've applied in New York, specifically to the case of Michael Bloomberg. Interesting to note, though, is the fact that the Times initially suggested that term limits should only be removed in New York City through a popular referendum. And this was something that when it really came down to it, the Times came out in another editorial saying, well, you know, maybe a referendum is not necessary. Maybe, you know, since we support this removal of term limits, we'll allow it to happen in, you know, a simple vote in city council.
This is significant, first of all, because they've said this is a small vote on the executive council that we're talking about would be sufficient.
Yes.
So they're in favor of dropping term limits for the mayor of New York. I guess they've been taking a different tack with Venezuela and Chavez. When the referendum was defeated the last time, the referendum against term limits in Venezuela, it's my understanding that the New York Times celebrated it. So on the other hand, what have they been saying about Colombia? We know that President Uribe has been trying to remove term limits in Colombia. Now, I presume the New York Times, at least, is against the extension of term limits in Colombia.
Yes, that's true, but it's what's interesting is to look at precisely what it is that the New York Times is saying about Colombia. Firstly, we should remember that Uribe, besides being a sort of bloodthirsty drug baron, is also someone who has already changed the Colombian constitution so that he could run a second time, so this being his second term, and he's about to change it or considering changing it so that he can run again. And what's interesting about what the Times says about Uribe is that It's sort of a pat on the back saying, Uribe, you've done a great job. Now is the time to sort of bow out while you're ahead, you know, to accept your position as a great Latin American leader and to say enough is enough and create a situation in which you can pass on the leadership to someone else. And what's interesting about this, of course, is that, as we said, the New York Times has a principled opposition to term limits, and yet they even feel as though they can't support the elimination of term limits in Colombia, because despite the fact that they clearly support Uribe.
So again, they're really playing with the kid gloves when it comes to Colombia and term limits. Uribe has tried to change the constitution more than once, hasn't he?
Yes, yes.
He's not even doing it by popular referendum, which is an important criteria for the New York Times.
That's right. He's doing it through a legislative vote. Bearing in mind this is a legislature, you know, that more than 36 members of this legislature are currently under investigation for ties with right-wing paramilitaries.
But again, let's talk then about the democratic credentials of Mr. Uribe. Again, the New York Times does call him Mr. Uribe, right?
Yes, this is an interesting difference, because they refer to Chavez as Hugo in an effort to demean him, to make him sound like a buffoon and a populist.
Okay.
Whereas Uribe is addressed in a sort of more polite form by the newspaper.
So they're more respectful to Uribe, but again, he's a friend of people like Pablo Escobar, right?
That's according to CIA documents. He was a close friend of Pablo Escobar. He was involved in paramilitary activity, and essentially, what's really shocking, what people that are outside of Colombia, I think, are failing to grasp is that it's really shocking that Uribe himself has not been removed from power over his ties to paramilitaries, because it was paramilitaries that got him elected, and this has been shown. His essential claim, though, is that since there are no direct and provable ties between him himself and paramilitary leaders that there's no reason to question his election. But what has been shown is that in a lot of areas controlled by paramilitaries, paramilitaries were forcing the population at gunpoint to vote for Uribe. And even so doing, the overall turnout in these elections is very low, because we also have to bear in mind the fact that Uribe, as a leader of the official Colombian state, doesn't actually control the entirety of the country.
Well, let's talk about his legitimacy then. What are his approval ratings in the polls?
That's what's actually kind of frightening, is that his approval ratings are very high, and they have been consistently. This is the one thing that the supporters of Uribe, especially in the United States, like to point out. But again, we should bear in mind that this is a society in Colombia, I should say, that's governed by fear, and it's governed by essentially the understanding that if you step out of line, violence will be directed your way. And this is something that Uribe has participated in himself. When he names journalists and criticizes them for attacking him, he's essentially subtly saying that their life is now in danger because of these sort of right-wing death squads that are loosely linked to him. And this is something that you see, for example, when the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, the Communist Guerrilla Army, attempted to enter the mainstream of political life in the 90s. They formed a political party and ran in elections, and within a couple of years, 4,000 members of that mainstream political party had been murdered.
Wow. So with all that excitement, I guess it's easy to overlook the other things, like the accusations of bribery or his apparent involvement in a pyramid scheme.
Yes.
Well, of course, the New York Times has been, as you said, giving him the nice treatment in contrast to Hugo, as they call the president of Venezuela. Then the last time that President Chavez tried to extend term limits, this was a referendum that happened in 2007, but he did not succeed in that referendum. Why would you say that this referendum didn't succeed last time?
I would say that the biggest thing that's overlooked about this referendum in the mainstream press coverage, because what you'll hear is the story that, Chavez tried this once already, failed, and now is trying it again, and that almost by definition proves that it's sort of an anti-democratic gesture that's been rejected already in the past. What's overlooked is that the 2007 referendum was an incredibly complex document. It was actually a reform of the Constitution rather than amendment, because it dealt with substantive changes to the Constitution. 69 articles were to be changed and rewritten, and it dealt with many elements that were unpopular even among the Chavista base, and that at the very least did not excite the Chavista base and turned off many powerful Chavista supporters who felt threatened by the reform, who then, as a result of that, did not really campaign in favor of that 2007 reform. So a whole series of complex dynamics went into the failure of the 2007 constitutional reform referendum. And what's important to note, though, is that by all accounts, if it had been just about Chavez's reelection, the 2000 referendum would have passed. And this, as I said in the article, this is something you can see in even the strategy of the opposition admits this, because the opposition strategy in that referendum was to say we aren't anti-Chavez, we don't oppose Chavez, we oppose this and this and this, educational reform, etc. And the Chavista strategy was to associate the reform directly with Chavez. And so, in essence, both sides were admitting that by all reasonable assessment, Chavez's own reelectability is something that would have passed. And this is something that we've now seen borne out in this victory in 2008.
Right. Well, let's talk about the opposition while we're at it. They hadn't been doing too well prior to this most recent referendum on the elections. I understand there had been a pro-Chavez demonstration and opposition students hurled objects at them. Even they were potentially caught with Molotov cocktails.
Yes, they were. A truck leading an opposition student march was stopped by police and was found to be full of at least materials, semi-prepared materials for Molotov cocktails. And this is something that's not entirely abnormal in Venezuela, but it's certainly something that contributed to an atmosphere of tension that was developing before the referendum.
They also ran pictures of, what was it, Greece, I think, from a few years back when they tried to show demonstrations being oppressed?
Yes, the claim in the... But made by the opposition students was that they were being violently repressed by police. And most people who were there and saw it knew that this wasn't true, that if for nothing else but strategic reasons, the Chavistas kept the police in line and kept them very restrained. The police lines, the first police lines that confront opposition student demonstrations don't even tend to carry any kind of weapon or tear gas or anything. They're just there with maybe shields or helmets. And it's the lines behind them that would have any tear gas. And what happened was that the students decided that they had to make an effort to claim that they had been repressed by the police. And so what they published in the press was a picture, an image, saying something about no to the repression of the democratic student movement or something like that. And the picture had actually been taken in Greece, where student movements were violently repressed. And so I think it's just very indicative of the state of the opposition movement today.
Well, I mean, just out of curiosity, these students, I mean, what kind of class background would you say they're from? Are these more well-off members of Venezuelan society?
Certainly. That's certainly the truth. And what's interesting is that they have this rhetorical strategy which consists of standing in and making themselves stand in for all students. But what's happened since Chavez has come to power is that the number of students in society has increased dramatically. You know, there's now education programs for people who couldn't afford education before. There's adult education programs. There are, you know, literacy programs. So all of these people who before were excluded from the category of student are now part of that category. And yet these students from elite universities, public or private, are making an effort to appear as though they represent the youth and they represent the students of Venezuela, which is just not true anymore.
This isn't the only problem within the opposition right now. It seems prior to this current referendum, they were still having trouble with public relations. There's that you mentioned a journalist from a youth-oriented TV program had surprised some opposition members, suggested that they were meeting with members of the U.S. government, and then the opposition members began spouting offensive slurs and threatening violence and so forth.
Yes, that was a very interesting event. It happened in the airport, and this young journalist just showed up with a camera and really caught opposition leaders off guard. These were representatives of all of the opposition parties, but you know, importantly and unsurprisingly, they also involved the head of Global Vision, which is the major opposition television network. And they had been in Puerto Rico by Chavista accounts. They'd been in Puerto Rico meeting with the State Department, and this was according to a leaked email. They were meeting with State Department officials to decide how much money the United States would be contributing to the opposition campaign to defeat the referendum, how that would be distributed, et cetera. And so it was according to these leaked emails that the journalists knew that they would be arriving in the airport, showed up, and began to ask them a number of uncomfortable questions, at which point the head of Global Vision, the opposition television channel, essentially threatened to punch the journalist for the accusations he was making. And so aside from being kind of comical, it revealed the buffoonery that is the Venezuelan opposition and that has been the Venezuelan opposition at least since 2001, 2002.
Well, it also has some lessons about the media, doesn't it? I mean, in Venezuela, it's clear there's a lot of discourse, a lot of discussion. It's all very exciting, the way newspapers and media programs are having fights and battles between different programs and so forth, and also the value of an independent media or an activist media bringing out that kind of information about the opposition. That's wonderful. Coming to this current election, or sorry, the current referendum, I might understand that Chavez was able to win the referendum to remove the term limits by about 54%.
Yep, I believe in the end it was 54.6%, and this is a referendum that would remove term limits on all elected officials, which also hadn't been proposed in the past. So this would also apply to mayors and governors. And as I said, part of the reason that that some of these mayors and governors weren't willing to campaign for the reform in its prior manifestation was because they felt threatened, because Chavez would have been reelectable, and yet they would not have been. The unfortunate side of this is that, you know, the mayors and governors are often some of the most corrupt officials in Venezuela, and so this creates a potential danger where you know, where it makes it more difficult for governors to be removed from office.
We've been making such a big deal about term limits as if it's the most important part of democracy. Where did this emphasis come from when you have a U.S. politics and U.S. newspapers talking about whether politicians should have term limits? I mean, who originated this?
I mean, this is a very old conception, but what I think is interesting in the U.S. context is that I, for example, grew up thinking that term limits was something inherent to democracy in the United States, without realizing that there were no presidential term limits prior to the 1940s, and without realizing that what I was growing up in and experiencing was actually a new right-wing populist rhetoric of the 1990s and the, you know, in the Republican Revolution of Newt Gingrich, which essentially presented term limits as as the most important element of institutional control over government. And this is something that doesn't accord well with reality of any country, and certainly doesn't reflect the history of the United States. And so I think the term limit debate in the United States is something that's going to continue. But what is more interesting, I think, to me, is the fact that is the way in which this is deployed hypocritically against other countries when it suits the United States government, or when it suits the New York Times. When they don't like a government, they accuse it of being tyrannical, and they use the question of term limits as a way of undermining that government to show that this is really just a political and strategic move, and not really a principled one at all.
As you mentioned, many important, whether they were good or bad, important Western leaders had long or no term limits, everyone from Thatcher and Reagan to FDR especially. Mm-hmm. So, again, when you're talking about pointing fingers or propaganda, that reminds me of the latest things that have been coming out after the bombing of Gaza. There's been accusations in the newspapers that Chavez is anti-Semitic, or his whole government is anti-Semitic, because they expelled the Israeli ambassador after that bombing. And I was just wondering if you had any comments on the validity of that.
Certainly. I mean, there's nothing valid about it at all, and it's actually part of a State Department strategy that goes back many decades, which consisted, for example, in Reagan using the accusation of anti-Semitism as an explicit strategy to discredit the Sandinista regime. And in this situation, in the case of Venezuela, the government is doing it, or I should say the former government was doing it, but it's even the press is stepping in to play this function on their own. So the Washington Post had an editorial with a shocking title, and the title was Hugo Chavez versus the Jews, which even in and of itself is meant to make Chavez out to be a rabid anti-Semite. And unfortunately for us, fortunately for these editorial writers, they don't really need to provide any facts. And so what they do is they essentially they provide a list of prior accusations, many of which have been discredited, all of which actually in this case have been discredited, and let them stand as though they were facts. So, for example, the Washington Post editorial cites the previous claim that Chavez had made an anti-Semitic remark when he referred to the people who killed Jesus, when this was something that has been shown to be a misquote, and a conscious misquote that was misquoted to make Chavez sound anti-Semitic, when actually he was making an anti-colonial statement and referring to Europeans and Romans. And so it's things like this that are allowed to stand in these sorts of editorials. And in the most recent case, the international press jumped all over the case of a break-in at a synagogue in Caracas, as though this was the ultimate proof and the final proof that they needed. They got very excited about this, the proof that they needed that Chavez was actually an anti-Semite. And so after several days of printing stories accusing the government of anti-Semitism, it came out that this was actually a robbery. This was a robbery carried out by the rabbi's former bodyguard, who was upset at not having been given a loan by the rabbi, and that the anti-Semitic graffiti that was painted on the walls was actually a cover for the fact that this was a robbery. And what's interesting is that after a full week probably of covering this as sure signs of Chavez's anti-Semitism, papers in the United States refused to print any retractions once it had been shown what had actually happened.
I guess this really, again, shows the importance of skepticism on anything you read in the newspaper, but especially when it relates to countries that the United States doesn't exactly support.
Absolutely.
Well, your articles actually have been very informative, and I'm just wondering where people should be looking to see your articles and other articles like it. Do you have websites that you like to frequent or send materials to?
I think Counterpunch is an excellent website. It has some of the best coverage of general news topics, but also Venezuela. Venezuela Analysis provides some good, balanced coverage. And I'd love to plug the blog bolrev.net, which is an excellent blog that spends a lot of its time tearing apart and dissecting U.S. media coverage specifically of Venezuela.
I haven't heard of some of those. I'm going to check it out. But I'd just like to say I'm extremely impressed. It's clear that everything you write in your articles is backed up by a wealth of knowledge that you can't necessarily fit in the article. But it was wonderful to get the background and hear all of the details that are involved in many of the things you were alluding to. So I wanted to thank you very much. This has been very educational, and I think people very much can benefit from listening to it. So I'm going to definitely be watching for your further articles when I'm looking at Counterpunch and other publications. So thanks very much, George, for coming on our program today.
Great. Thank you very much for having me.
No problem. Thank you. Bye-bye.
And that was George Ciccariello Marr. He is a PhD candidate at Berkeley University. He's also a writer, journalist, activist. He's been covering a lot about what's happening in Venezuela, and he's been able to write several articles on that. So very impressed by what he was able to tell us on our program today. We're going to take a musical break, and then we might have some announcements. And after that, we're going to get some updates on what's happening with the upcoming Israel Apartheid Week. And we'll be speaking, presumably, to a member of the McMaster Muslims for Peace and Justice.